The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. This content is created in partnership with our sponsor, Zurich Australia Limited, ABN 92000010195, AFSL 232510, and is limited to publicly available information. Before acting on any general advice, you should consider whether appropriate and obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license and does not provide any financial advice or services or endorse any general advice. If a PDS or IM exists, you should obtain a copy and review it thoroughly before making a decision.
Welcome to the Life Insurance Podcast for Ensemble. I'm your host, Ben Donald, Managing Director of Life Advice Partners and currently completing a doctorate in life insurance. My goal is simple, improving life insurance outcomes for Australians. This podcast series is all about bringing life insurance back onto the radar for advisors across the country. Each episode features real conversations with the people who live and breathe this work every day, uncovering the lessons, processes, and the stories that help advisors lift confidence, capability, and client outcomes. Whether you write 2 policies a year or 200, this podcast is here to help you deliver better protection, build stronger businesses, and ultimately serve more Australians. Let's jump in.
Zurich is proud to be supporting this episode. Experience Zurich and OnePath advisor portals with new and improved digital capabilities and an enhanced range of self-service functionality, helping make your business more efficient, saving you time and removing complexity. It's everything you need in one place. Partner with us today.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ben Donald and welcome to episode 1 of the Life Insurance Podcast. With me today, I'm very delighted to have with us a risk strategy specialist from Zurich, the Mr. Adam Crabb, and another risk insurance specialist who I think a lot of you may have heard of. She's won a lot of awards and been around for a little bit of time, Catherine Hayes. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ben. Great to be here.
Excellent. Thanks for coming on board. Look, before we kick off, we'll do the usual sort of thing. So just a little bit of background about the both of you. Adam, mate, how long have you been in insurance?
Probably too long. Some may say or longer than I've liked to admit.
That's fine.
This is true. Yeah. Look, casting the mind back, my first role in life insurance would have been in an advice capacity. So I picked up what they were called proper authorities way back when, at the turn of the century.
I was going to say that's 18 when.
Yeah, pretty much 1845. It was around 2000.
Yeah.
So I had a proper authority, which was for those listening, FSR. So the financial services from prior to that, I think they were proper authorities before moving across into authorized reps. So it was in advice for quite some time. Then you could argue joined the dark side. I worked in an advice licensee for a few years before then jumping in and joining Zurich, which was back in 2018. So, yeah. Just a little over 25 years.
That's a big journey. And why did you move away from advice?
Yeah, I found that the passion around insurance and advice is still there even today. It's more around the specialization of life risk. So the move away from advice was into a pure insurance role. So I manage the insurance APL.
Yep.
I often say publicly, I was paid for the privilege of reading insurance PDS, Ben, which I know sounds like the dream job. But gave me phenomenal insight into the really broad landscape of product design through direct group retail, of course.
Yeah.
And got some phenomenal understanding of the mechanics of insurance that often I think advice doesn't really understand too well at the coal phase. Then made the transition into life insurance specifically and on the education side and
been a lovely. Yeah. Yeah. Indeed. Because I think, Kath, how many times do you think you would have seen Adam up on stage?
Countless times.
Yeah. He's one of sort of 5 specialists left in the industry, mate.
Not many of us.
Yeah. So thank you. Thank you for flying the flag. And I think that's relatively true across the advice space as well. Speaking about risk specialist, Kath, what about yourself?
Yeah. Well, I started in the industry as a holistic advisor. Like many, I got my start in the bank and then moved outside of that so I could actually see what, for lack of a better word, what real financial planning looked like. So I started on that focus and pretty much did everything except insurance. I've shared this story in the past.
That'd be a probably pretty familiar thing to all our listeners out there, everybody doing everything except insurance. Sorry to cut you off. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, but 2008... that kicked off a series of 3 tragedies over a short span of time in 6 months, and where one person passed away, another with breast cancer, another had a stroke. These were all people who were close to me, and the oldest person was 32.
Oh, wow.
So I had the guilt around not addressing that area. They weren't clients of mine, but I still carry guilt anyway, so I decided to focus on risk for the next 12 months. Mm. And 17 years later, here we are.
It's a pretty standard, isn't it? You know, it's similar to financial advice. You sort of fall into it. You don't plan to be into it, but once you're in it, you love it and you want to stay.
Yep.
Yeah. Can I ask, so starting your practice, when did that happen?
Well, in terms of going from employee to business owner, it was a transition stage. So around about 2014, I became a part owner in a practice. And then about 5 years later, I bought out the business partners, rebranded to the name of the business that it is today. And carried on since then.
And just for everybody who might not be watching, Hayes & Co. So I'm guessing they used to be some other name. Now it's just the Co., which is
the name. Yeah.
Fair. Yeah.
Correct. My business was an attachment to a mortgage brokerage, so it carried their name prior to that.
Yeah, very, very natural sort of.
Now, Ben, knowing this is like podcast number one, I think it's only fair and reasonable that perhaps the audience understands a bit about you and your background.
Yes. So similar to Kath and similar to probably a lot of people listening is I fell into financial advice be close to 20-odd years ago, started in a holistic practice and then jumped to the real dark side where all the fun is on the life insurance about 16-odd years ago. Started as a junior advisor in a relatively larger corporate, and over the last 14, 15 years, did a lot of fun stuff, but effectively grew that business, turned into the MD maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and went through all the changes in industry. We've been through all that sort of stuff. It was wonderful to be able to live the life of being an advisor, but then becoming a business manager, and then eventually sold out July just gone, and kicking off the practice very shortly. But ultimately, my goal and why I want to do this is I want to improve life insurance outcomes in Australia, and I think the platform that we have here to talk to more and more financial planners is the right way to go about it.
It's interesting listening to certainly that story, and I think Catherine, even my own situation, you talk to many that work in this current and wonderful industry. We get here almost by accident, whether it's through just the path that's led us there, or as Catherine articulated, I think you've got those stories that touch close to home. I know with me, we've had family members with cancer, with heart issues, dementia, suicide. Like, it's those sorts of events where something catastrophic happens. Yes, of course, there's the financial assistance, but you're really partnering with people to better protect them and ensure that they are actually looked after over the long term.
Learning happens every day through meetings, podcasts, professional conversations. Make every moment count at cpdcheck.com.
Yeah, I find it's a bit of a calling now. It certainly wasn't when I started. I don't remember growing up saying I want to be an insurance advisor. I think I just wanted to get a stick and hit things. But now, yeah, hopefully a little bit more sophisticated. What about yourself, Kath? What did you want to do when you grew up?
When I was really young, I wanted to either be a tennis star or a diplomat.
So instead, mum and dad, very proud because I've turned into a life insurance specialist.
Yeah,
legends. Yeah,
my parents, one wanted me to be an accountant and the other wanted me to be a lawyer, but I did not want to do either.
Yeah, smart decision, I think, moving into life. Yeah. Thank you guys for that. So just reflecting on why we're sort of running this podcast, the idea of getting financial planners to be a lot more involved in life insurance, because we know a lot of people have moved away from it. I think it's important for everybody listening, just if we get a bit of an understanding of what the current state of play looks like within Australia for life insurance. And, you know, Adam, that's a large part of the reason you're here, mate, is you're from one of the largest insurers. Can you take us through, almost feel like putting a stopwatch on this because it feels like we could talk about it for too long. But, mate, what does it look like at the moment?
We certainly could. Look, there is some positive, some green shoots. We have been through quite a challenging period over the last, let's call it 5-10 years. Mm. We've had legislative impacts, which have really created a level of complexity for advisors. Mm-hmm. Over and above that, obviously, we've had changes in remuneration. So the amount of income that's been earned by insurance professionals obviously has been decreasing. Mm. Back in the heyday of what, 110, 120?
I know. And even you go to New Zealand, it's 250, I think. So
pretty attractive, isn't it?
Yeah. If it weren't for the All Blacks, I'd probably very fun.
This is true.
Yeah.
So certainly I think the remuneration piece is certainly and complexity has made it really challenging. Coupled with the education pathways, which really has seen quite a significant exodus of certainly not just risk specialists, but I think advisors more broadly.
Yeah.
And those that have flourished or certainly survived, I think are the likes of Catherine and others that have perhaps gone down that specialization So really working on, and certainly I think part of this podcast would be terrific to understand, you know, Catherine's journey in more detail. But what we see, those that have really worked closely on their process, on their efficiencies, being able to deliver that advice far less cumbersome compared to those that are still perhaps working in the holistic space that may charge a fee for service, you know, 4 or 5K to really make it a value add from them as well as their clients to provide that advice. And what we've seen is certainly the level of new business that's been written in insurance has decreased. So the highs of, you know, close to a bill only a few years ago, sort of hit the low of around 300 mil, but we've started to see that to increase over the last 12 to 18 months.
Yeah. And in terms of advisor volumes, so not just new business, we know that's, you know, it's fallen off the perch, but what are advisors doing? So I hear stats that there are about 400 risk specialists in the country. What does that look like?
Yeah, that's about right. So we find that across the, 15,000 advisors, there's only a few hundred that are predominantly writing a sort of the main amount of new business that's going through.
Yeah.
But once again, we are starting to see an increase, not just in those risk specialists providing advice. We're starting to see the holistic advisors that are far more curious.
Yeah.
They see the value of at least extending their current advice offering into insurance advice and re-entering, so starting to write a bit more new business.
Yeah, okay. So, Catherine, as a risk specialist, right, and reflecting on the fact that we have been through sort of 10 years of troubled times and we are starting to come through it, can you talk me through what it looks like from your lens, looking at your existing clients that you look after at the moment? What's that been like for them for the last sort of 5-10 years?
Yeah, the biggest challenges that we've had is really been those legislative changes. So, I mean, I was fortunate in that we focused on a hybrid model as far as commission went before it became, you know, the new norm.
The old 80-20.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yep. So and that was already a focus for us. But one of the biggest disruptions for us was really the, I would say, the change to the new RDII products. That was a huge rite of change in terms of it was a boon for business because everyone wanted to get in before that happened.
Yep, yep.
But, you know, the flow-on effect for that is now that we're starting to see the pricing, the re-rating from insurances. We've had Integrity exit the market.
Yeah.
So there's challenges around that side. We've had insurer consolidation. So all of this just simply means, you know, I guess more reviews with our clients, helping them adjust when faced with a cost of living crisis. Yeah. So that is probably the biggest thing that I have noticed over the last 5 years.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure points, isn't it? And even if we extend that into claims, and I think it's actually, for everybody sort of listening, it's good to take this from a global perspective. The pressures on the claims, for example, Adam, can you talk us through right now? TPD is under a lot of pressure. It's in the news, you know, APRA and ASIC are writing letters. Yeah. Cali's looking at things. What does it look like from your lens in terms of how does Australia compare to the rest of the world when it comes to a product like TPD?
Like how long have we got in this podcast? Chat through. It's look, income protection and TPD are probably the most topical products that I speak about. And like Catherine mentioned, RDII has been one of the big issues. And what are we, 5 years now?
I think 2020 it came in.
Yeah. So, cessation of agreed value, I think, around March of 2020. And then the significant change in products in that quarter three or four in 2021. And what are we now, 2025, coming into 2026.
Yep.
And I'm certainly still being asked for education content on comparing the pre-IDIIs, those those with those forward pain benefits, spec injury, trauma advancements, all these sort of bells and whistles.
Yeah.
And comparing them to the, you know, the current state of play. And I've no doubt that's likely to continue moving forward. And of course, TPD, as you mentioned, it's an area that has gone through not a lot of change from a product or design perspective.
When did it first launch? Like, when did we first see TPD in Australia?
40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, right. And has the product changed much?
Look, a little, but not a lot.
Yeah.
When you look back at the genesis of TPD, and look, you may know this yourself, but you know, there's older. I look at you, but I think you're of a
I'm not 40, 50 years old.
No. But I'm thinking back to conventional products. So these are whole of life endowment. Been it before, people listening, I start glazing over. These were a product which had a combination of an insurance component and a savings element.
Yep.
And they were, as the name suggests, bundled together. Whole of life focused more on the insurance, endowment more on the savings element. I mention that because TPD was sometimes a rider or supplementary benefit to those contracts.
Yeah.
Obviously, fast forward a few years, even 40, 50 years ago, it became more of a standalone contract. And around the time of super guarantee contributions coming in, so sort of 1992, memory serves, we really started to see a separation of products. So if people wanted, you know, to invest for their retirement, they'd choose a superannuation vehicle for it. Insurance was then more selected as that standalone offering.
Yeah.
So sort of the beginning of the end for the bundled contracts. And really TPD, Ben, hasn't changed a lot in terms of the product design over that period. Yet the nature of claims that we receive, and I can't really speak for other insurers, but I've no doubt similar, the way in which we work, significantly different.
Yep.
So back in the 80s, 90s, one in four workers in Australia were mining, manufacturing, agriculture.
Yep.
Today, very different, right? So the nature of claims relating to those events was musculoskeletal. It was catastrophic in nature.
Yeah.
But today it's things like mental health, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, chronic pain. It's those things which you can't get an X-ray, an MRI, a CT scan for.
Yeah, the subjective.
Very subjective in nature.
Yeah.
And this significant lift in mental health, and look, people are far more cognizant of their health and well-being, and you get medical specialists that perhaps are toying with the idea of saying, well, look, perhaps there's a chance that you may not work again.
Yeah.
We are starting to see this massive increase.
So effectively, society's moved on to a new way of operating, and the insurance contracts that existed 40, 50 years ago just haven't kept up.
That's true. Probably the biggest change in the TPD space happened about 10 years ago, in 2016. One of the large group super funds then actually completed an exercise of research. And what they did is they contacted a few hundred of their own members. And these are members who had received a TPD benefit.
Yep.
And a couple of years had passed, and they contacted them and asked them a simple question. What are you doing? Around a third of them were either back at work or looking for work.
Yeah, well.
So that was the trigger for change in their own product set, which meant that the default offering for that particular fund, rather than paying TPD as a lump sum, it was installment.
Yeah.
And it was over, say, a five-year period. There's been some tweaks in the contract since, but effectively you're eligible just for a portion of your TPD, then after 12 months reassessed, then another portion, then again reassessed.
Yeah, it's where temporary doesn't necessarily mean permanent, doesn't necessarily mean temporary. Yeah.
Correct. Now, Zurich, look, in our world, we released continuous care option last year.
Yep.
So focusing.
I'm going to have to cut you off there, mate. That's enough about Zurich. Thank you. But it's good to see. You're right. Like all the insurers are trying to do it, right? They are trying to address it because it is it's a growing issue.
And more needs to happen.
Yeah.
So you're right. As you said earlier on, you know, the industry's talking about it, Cali's behind it. Mm. And I really am excited to see what happens over the course of the next 6 to 12 months, just to see if there is scope to have a broader change in TPD or see other offerings enter the market.
So can I ask then, and Kath, feel free to chime in here, right? So we've just talked about the fact that the market's gone through quite a lot of change since maybe 2018 when LIF started, right? And now we're talking about the fact that TPD, potentially we're going to be watching it for the next 12 months to see where that lands. Is it a time, do you think, for financial planners to get back into life insurance, or should they be waiting for things to settle? What do you think, Adam?
Look, I think there's never a better time than now.
Yep.
Agree, it is complex. Mm-hmm. I think IDII has certainly made it challenging. I think if you're re-entering insurance, but it, from what we hear, particularly those holistic advisors that are now re-entering, you get involved in just a single claim.
Mm.
And it will fundamentally change the way that you speak with future clients moving forward, regardless of the strategy you're working on.
Yeah.
It's those trigger events that happen in someone's situation that are life-changing, and you have that client for life where you form part of that exploration, that journey, that strategy with them moving forward.
I'd ask the question, Kath, have you ever had a client go through claim and then not stay on or refer clients to you?
Yeah, every client who's been through a claim has become, my biggest advocate.
Yeah, no, 100%. And my story is not dissimilar to the both of you. I remember falling in love, I guess, with life insurance. It was a horrible set of circumstances, but I was sitting at the kitchen dinner table with a client who had brain cancer, and his wife was making us both chicken rolls. And we were talking about the terminal illness benefit that was going to be payable, and the fact that he wasn't going to be here in 6 months. And, you know, you could see the body language change as we had the conversation, because he was able to relax into it a little bit more, knowing that his family would be looked after. And the same thing from her. And for the financial planners, if you have an opportunity to immerse yourself in and have a bigger, larger conversation with a client going through a claim, I very much would strongly recommend 100% that you do it. Because as Adam said, as Kath said, if you live that experience, you know, once, could be a handful of times or whatever it may be, it drives home and I think really brings to light the value of what life insurance does. You know, you could have 2%, 3%, 4% returns, but if you sit down with somebody and you say, hey, you can't work, but because of the insurance policy that we established for you, you are going to be getting this money until you turn 65 or a lump sum. It's horrible, but it's also a great feeling to be able to deliver that sort of message to somebody.
Yeah, agree. And I look, for those listening that are perhaps hesitant or feel, gosh, they've been out for too long and it sounds like it's hard. How do you do it? I think having people like Catherine and others in the industry that you could perhaps call upon and liaise with if you know them. Otherwise, what you could potentially do is just reach out to a local charity. I see some advisors doing this where they might partner with a certain institution. It could be related to cancer, stroke, or heart, where you're actually helping someone from a philanthropic perspective. It may just be once every quarter. It may not even relate to insurance, but the fact that you're helping navigate someone who's gone through like a shocking situation like the one you mentioned, even if it's just early access to super, something that people may not think about, can be an absolute game changer and can really help step you back into that risk protection, you know, mindset.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. I recently signed up with the Pro Bono Advice Network to do exactly that. Previously signed up with the Cancer Council and one or two other charities, but I'll be looking to do at least once a quarter to get involved.
Good.
And claim for, you know, just to do the right thing. Because I think as financial planners, we've been through the ringer and we don't necessarily have the greatest reputation. So I think it's incumbent upon us to become the change that we want to see in the industry. And we've got to advocate. And that starts with everybody here who's listening. Go out of your way to help somebody around you that needs the help. All right. So we've gone through the current state of play and we've just sort of touched on what that could do to the individual practice that's looking at life insurance. So the way that I look at in life insurance inside a practice and why we want to get involved, it's sort of a three-tier component to it. You've got a legal requirement, an ethical requirement, and a commercial requirement. So I'm tempted to pass back to Adam, but why don't we get to the commercial straight away instead, and we talk to you, Kath. Can I ask, just from your experience as a risk specialist, what are you seeing in the market talking to financial planners? I mean, Adam mentioned before that you spend a lot of time talking to them, and I know there's a lot of guys out there like Phil Thompson who are more than happy to share their ideas, their business acumen, and talk to people about it. But what do you see in partnering with financial planners from a risk perspective?
Yeah, I think the rate of change that we've seen over the last couple of years, a lot of financial advisors, because it's not just in the insurance industry. I mean, we've had a huge amount of change. But when you compile that with all the changes that have been coming out on the holistic side, it hasn't been really commercial for a lot of holistic practices. They have stepped away because they've got so much to keep on top of. So what we found is there are a lot of advice practices. They know that it's important. They know that it needs to be addressed, but they're not on top of it. So as part of their duty to care, they said, look, you're going to be better served by somebody else doing that.
Yeah.
So that's when, you know, we've been, you know, asked to step in and help out with clients where they just know that it's outside of their depth. So we're seeing a lot of that.
Yeah. How do the conversations start? Like, so do you have to sort of demonstrate? Do you get thrown a few referrals to start with? Do you have to demonstrate your claims experience, your capabilities? What does it look like when you start to engage with a financial planner?
Well, for me, initially when it first started, it was actually thanks to my BDMs at the various insurance companies. They would go around to various practices. And they were actually convincing some of the advisors, look, you really need to stop doing risk advice.
politely. Yeah.
You know, and they said, oh, well, you know, who would you refer to? So, you know, it was advisors in my local region. And the advisor would say, hey, Catherine treats her clients like family. I would suggest her. So that's how it started. It did get to a point where I was at my capacity. So I was actually turning away. So I was actually offering to train. You know, I was encouraging practices, please bring somebody on. I will help train them. I will provide them input. We need more risk advisors. And about a year ago, I actually just took on an advisor who was holistic to become a risk advisor in my practice. So we can turn around and start saying, yes, we have capacity to help you. Brilliant. So we're back in that now, working with new advisors again.
Yeah, and so you've got the right skill set there to deliver that service to the client. And I imagine the financial planner themselves that's referring that client, it makes a lot more sense for them as a business to be doing that, right? For professionally, and but also commercially from a P&L point of view.
That's right. If a business is willing to invest in the time and energy in having a staff member who's doing that, I think that's fantastic from a number of levels. You know, there is more insurance work when you can poke a stick at out there in terms of the market. You know, I think it's great for a business's future valuation and its stickiness of a client. You know, so it makes sense to offer a risk within a practice.
Yeah,
I'd agree. And in fact, Ben and I were chatting offline prior to the session on some of the other legislative changes that have happened. Protect Your Super, putting members' interest first. And these have had such a massive flow-on effect on even young Australians getting access to even basic default cover.
Yeah.
So I think Catherine's absolutely right that not only is there so many clients out that need assistance, you could argue that pool is growing substantially.
Yeah.
Because people are probably yet to understand the full nature of just the lack of cover they've now got through their super or what they used to have through their super. So yeah, significant opportunity.
Yeah, I think we were reading some fun stats before. I think from 2018 to 2023, there was a 36% reduction in the lives insured through superannuation because of legislation. It's horrifying.
It's millions.
Really?
Millions of people. Yeah.
So what are you seeing then, Adam? So in terms of financial planners, right, you deal with guys that are risk specialists, obviously, but you spend a lot of time presenting at conferences that, you know, some are financial planning conferences, some are risks. I imagine there's aged care, whatever it may be. What do you see from a holistic point of view?
Yeah, it's a real mixed bag. And on the commercial side of what you're asking, Catherine, I think part of the attraction, I think, to many holistic advisors is the value of that client on their book, particularly now with the 20% trail. It can be a sizable addition to the value of their business.
Yeah.
But yeah, look, the range of different advice professionals out there is quite wide ranging.
Yep.
I did a PD day this morning and talking with, again, holistic advisors, and some of them are re-entering the area of insurance by helping their clients through claims.
Yeah.
And really sort of trying to pick our brain on, look, what's the sort of the best avenue to attack here, talking different products, the interrelation with how they work.
Yeah.
So, you know, Catherine mentioned, you know, partnering with your insurer BDM, and look, I would agree, and not just ours, but whoever you deal with, they are a wealth of knowledge. They can share your insights on, you know, businesses that are perhaps around you, sharing those that valuable intel as to how they're operating.
Yeah, I think that's really good for everybody that's not touching life insurance at the moment, is to just to realize we as life specialists, right? So Kath, myself, and pretty much every other life specialist I know, because there's not a huge number of us, we don't really compete with each other. I think in the 14 years that I ran a business with sort of 9,000 clients, I think I saw one SOA from another advisor the entire time, and that's 14 years.
Right.
That's, you know, that's hundreds of SOAs every year. So there's more market out there than anybody can sort of manage. And so if you are a financial planner and you are thinking about life insurance and you're not quite sure what to do, I definitely would encourage you to, you know, jump on the insurance space on the Ensemble platform, reach out to people like Kath. Just have a look at it, because it really is worth it. And if you watch, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say other names, but there's certain presentations. I think Sue Viskovich does a really good presentation where she talks about research that she's done, I think, across a couple of hundred practices. And she can demonstrate just through statistical analysis, interviewing all these practices, that the financial planning practices that have risk as part of their offer are substantially more profitable.
Correct.
And that's a relatively safe level of income that sort of sits at that 20% trail. You adjust it upwards and downwards as you need to. It might be growing every year because premiums are growing. It doesn't necessarily require the level of signatures on an annual basis in terms of ongoing fees and whatnot. So it really is a strong avenue that I think everybody should be looking at. But moving forward then, so that's the sort of commercial component about it, but looking at the legal and the ethical obligations, if you're an aged care specialist, why should I care about life insurance?
It's a great question. And I think based on the experience we're having in our business at Zurich is that we are partnering with advisors who are at least having the conversation. So if you're that aged care specialist, you're having a lot of conversations with the kids. Arguably, they may hold a power of attorney, injury guardianship. And so it's not just a situation about the financial well-being of the parents in that example, but of themselves, maybe even their children. So we are seeing more work, more insurance being written either in the name of the owned by the elderly parent on the life insured of the adult child, or indeed around children.
Okay.
Some other advisors I chat to are doing it differently, where they're structuring the product in the name of the, say, the policy owner, life insured being the same, mm-hmm. but it's being funded by the grandparent in that situation. Yeah. So, you know, while the aged care specialist may not have a great knowledge around insurance, it's just that, you know, what if, what would happen if something prevented you from being able to work, being able to provide care for that particular child? That aged care specialist may not be able to provide that service in-house, but could be more than willing to perhaps refer it out.
So if we move then down a couple of years, right, let's go back a couple of decades for your client. So that's the aged care specialist. If Kath, tell me, why would you want to talk to a 60-year-old or a 50-year-old about life insurance?
Yeah, well, I guess my brain goes off in a few tangents, but, you know, I have people who are 65 and still want their insurance. Usually it's business owners in that category. They still require it as part of buy sells and other elements. And people are working longer. They have bigger mortgages. So that's a really large element. But also when it comes to people having kids later in life, you know, we're seeing people have kids in their...
That's perfect, because I was actually going to prompt you to say that. So thanks for bringing it up.
And a big part of my conversation that clients have had for a while, that their kids are getting older. Mm. You know, we're now having conversations where we're converting child cover policies into adult policies and having that decision around who funds it. I mean, I see people talk about, you know, how expensive it is to add their child to the car insurance policy and what that costs. So we're insuring, you know, $30,000 car, $50,000 car, and it costs a fortune and there's a huge excess. Now, you look at a child cover policy, you know, it's about $1 per month per child for about every $10,000 worth of cover.
Yep.
It's peanuts. So we talk about insuring a car, but the driver is really the most important aspect.
Yeah.
And when you put it in those terms, you know, people go, why wouldn't I insure my child? And it protects their retirement, it protects their kid. And if it becomes an adult policy, you know, in some cases we're talking about multi-life discounts, and sometimes the premiums for the kid end up resulting in the adult policy being more than discounted by the cost of the child policy. So,
yeah.
For me, it's just all about retention and generational planning.
Yeah, some of the financial planners that I talk to, they sort of talk about risk return, right? And the biggest risk to any parent's financial plan is the children being unwell. And that's when any sane parent would be making emotional decisions, not financial decisions. So I don't care what the plan is, I just want my kid to be better. And so it's a good way to protect the financial plan of the adult, but then also to introduce that next generation of client into your business. Because as you say, right, the 18-year-old child cover, that'll become an adult policy at 19, 20 or whatever it may be, and then that carries forward. It's a good way to segue the next generation into full financial advice, especially prior to them necessarily having enough FUM to be, you know, what a financial planner would call an ideal client.
Then you might know the work that we did with Cost of Care at Zurich.
No, never heard of it. Never what is it? What's Cost of Care, please?
So with Cost of Care Volume 2, one of the big requests that we had from advisors, those that love the original Cost of Care, was to build a chapter devoted to infant children for the discussion that you're having. It's the prompter, it's that awakening, because what we found with the research was if you have two individuals that suffer the same condition, say leukemia, one impacts a child, one impacts an adult, the financial impact is always greatest on the child. So I think people need to understand that, you know, God forbid if it happened to you or your children, right?
Mm.
You would want to stop what you're doing and be by your bedside. 100%.
Yeah.
Your own personal cover is likely to do nothing for them. Mm-hmm. So it really is, I think, an eye-opener, the way in which many riskies are positioning the need for child cover with their clients.
Yeah. So I guess in that sense, we sort of know that it's the right thing to do ethically and legally, but commercially, obviously, it makes a lot of sense. So how does, for all the people listening at home, how does a financial planner go from four policies a year? What's the process that they embark on to get to maybe 10 policies a year? How do they start doing instead of dabbling?
I guess if it was, you know, certainly a question that our team was asked, it would be to work closely with the BDM.
Yep.
Understand that you're not going to be thrown straight in, particularly if there's been a period of absence.
Yeah.
There are tools and resources available that can actually help them. So one of the things I often hear risk specialists say is part of their core differential, particularly from holistic advisors, and I'd be interested in Catherine's thoughts on this, are things like field underwriting and understanding the pre-assessment process, because that can be quite cumbersome.
Mm.
But insurers now have tools available that can make an advisor a quasi underwriter. a lot of drop-down fields. What's the condition? Oh, it's diabetes type 2. And you can sort of pop in, what's the hemoglobin, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
So you don't need to be caught out and go, oh, gee, I don't know. Tell me as much as you can and I'll go and find that information out. You know, with technology, we've got access, or advisors have access to a lot of those tools that can really help them take the client through that journey.
Yeah. What about yourself, Catherine? What's the sort of the journey that you see a financial planner going through? Why is there hesitation from them to get into life?
Yeah, I think it comes down to that rate of change or the perceived commerciality aspect of it. But I think we're entering a period of time where the rate of change has become more steady. You know, there's still change, but it's not as, you know,
it's so fast that we've just lost track of how fast it's moving.
Changes to TPD, but it's not like the RDII changes. So I think if people are willing to spend the time just to bring themselves up to speed, there's so many resources people can avail themselves of. But once they've done that, you know, start small, talk to the client, you know, part of the duty of care, and really just go from there and find a way to be efficient in the processes. I think that's really important. You know, I know that some practices, they formally pre-assess just about every condition with every insurer, and I think that's bad for the business, bad for the client, bad for insurers. So I think one of the best ways I think to start would be to look at the most common conditions you see pop up.
Yep.
You know, golden rules, you know, if there's been, let's say, if you've had a lower back muscle strain in the last 12 months or you're currently having physio, you know, no matter which insurer you ask, that's going to be a low back exclusion, you know, for example. There's no point pre-assessing that.
So
I would say the core most common things, get a really good understanding where it's going to be the same across the board no matter which insurer you go to.
Yeah.
And then that way you can reserve your pre-assessing to, you know, the more unusual items, the less common elements. And then, of course, use the resources if you're not sure what's common, what's not, by, picking up the phone, having a chat to an underwriter, or using those automated tools that you can do at, you know, any time of day without needing somebody.
Kieran, are we able to get some of the links to those tools? So Adam, you mentioned before about the pre-assessment tool. What does that look like?
So, look, ours, for example, is built into our quoting software.
Yep.
So once you pop in your client, Ben Donald, age, income, $1 million a year, all that sort of stuff, you've got the ability to hit pre-assess.
Yeah.
And it's literally just another question set that pops up.
Yep. Is there anything before that? And this is going somewhere. Do you have any sort of, is there a Microsoft Forms or something along those lines that we can send out to clients prior?
We do have them as well. Yep. So some firms are using ours there, just white labeling them.
Yep. May have done the exact same thing. What about yourself, Catherine? Do you also steal insurers' data and tech?
Not too much these days, but I would say that one of the best things that we did to make sure that we're prepared, we look good in our clients and, you know, we're the experts, is we get clients to do, you know, we have two questionnaires, a health questionnaire and a basic fact find, and we get them sure.
Yep.
But the health fact find that we do, I mean, I've shared it publicly in the past and you can find it and copy it and brand it your own if you like, if you go onto Jotform. But we have that completed before the client comes in. And if there's a condition that I look at there and I go, never come across.
It's Latin and I don't understand it.
Yeah, that's right. Then I will pick up a phone to an underwriter and say, hey, I've got this client. This is what I know. What information do you need so I can come back to you with a good pre-assessment? So they'll say, these are the questions we would want you to ask. So when we have the meeting, I ask those questions. So then post-meeting, you know, we can have a really good conversation and make sure we're sending through complete info. So I think being prepared beforehand, and that's saving you, you know, like having that information, it saves you time because your time is the valuable element.
Catherine, can I ask you, how often or what's your view on actually sending out a blank fact find to clients before the meeting? Is that something that you do?
Every time.
Yeah. Now, I don't know about you, Catherine, but when I first had this proposed to me in the business maybe a year ago or so, I was really, really reluctant to try it. I thought clients would never do this. You're joking. It's never going to happen. But I think I was a little bit embarrassed to admit that I think we had one client out of a couple of hundred that turned around and said, oh, mate, can we just have a chat over the phone? So we were having effectively 100% hit rate on a blank fact find and a blank health questionnaire. And this is a really, you know, it's the Zurich one effectively that we took and sort of white labeled. We had 100% success with clients filling that out and coming back to us.
That's great.
Yeah, it shocked me to bits and pieces.
It's about the expectation that you set, and to put it point blank, we tell clients that if that form is not completed within 24 hours prior to their appointment, like that's the deadline, their appointment will be cancelled. And some clients are waiting 2 to 3 months to get in. So they want to complete that form. So, you know, it's fairly, you know, fairly non-negotiable on our end. And, but the other thing is we also say, you know, I've seen some fact finds of certain, you know, other practices.
Mm.
I wouldn't complete that for some of the stuff that's consent. So keep it short. Like we keep it very high level. It's more of a door to opening more questions rather than tell me everything that's ever existed in your life, you know, full budget. There's a ways to be efficient in the way you go about it. Make it lower the friction point for clients and they will complete it.
The cancellation puts the client on notice, doesn't it? It's great.
I'm blown away by that, Catherine. That's fantastic. It's great. I can steal lots of intel as I set up again. And I guess for every financial planner, that's not quite sure how to approach this and might be a little bit embarrassed about asking questions for the pre-assessment and whatnot, these forms are readily available everywhere. And as Catherine's just said, as Adam said, and as I've experienced, there's effectively 100% success rate on it. Clients are really comfortable to answer questions about their health through these forms and then submit them in order to make the meeting as productive as possible. That's brilliant to hear. And I guess in a way, in my mind, and I imagine for you as well, Catherine, can you tell me what this did to the cost profile? What was your cost of acquisition? What happened once clients started doing that?
Well, they're committed to the process. I mean, that's it at the end of the day. It saves me time. We do a better job with our pre-assessments. And we save time in the meeting because generally the beginning of the conversation is, you know, we do all our meetings online. So, A, we confirm that the meeting's being recorded and the reasons why.
Yep.
And then the second part is like, thank you for doing the pre-work. Let's kick off by me regurgitating back to you my understanding of your situation and let's just fill in a couple of gaps.
Yeah.
It just saves so much time and then they feel that you want to understand, you want to get to know them rather than talking about the, you know, hygiene elements that, you know, kind of wasting your time and theirs when it can be done in advance.
Can I ask what happens? Because conversion rate's really, really important, right? When a client comes in the door versus when a policy starts, you want it to be as high as possible. Some businesses will be sort of 90%+, others might sit around the 50%. My experience, again, running a relatively large practice, was that putting these forms online and making them mandatory before the client showed up, that closed our, or so that improved our closure rate by about 10-20%. That was phenomenal for us. So we saw our cost to serve on an insurance acquisition client go from maybe 3,200 down to sort of closer to 2,500 because we weren't wasting time with multiple meetings with a client who ultimately wasn't going to proceed. One, because of health reasons, or two, because they didn't want to tell us any issues. But also we were able to get a lot of, as you say, a lot of that, not necessarily waste conversation, but we were able to make the time with the client as effective as possible by having all the nitty-gritty like name, date of birth, all that sort of stuff sorted beforehand.
Yeah, 100% agree. There are appointments that do not go ahead because we see the health questionnaire. It means picking up the phone and saying, look, unfortunately, we are not going to be able to help you. Sometimes that will lead to still going ahead with an appointment, but it's focused on, say, the partner or the kids, or it still leads to an opportunity, but, you know, we're not wasting their time and ours.
So I reckon that'd probably be the number one tip from the whole podcast so far is that pre-assessment and use the tools that are available from the insurers and from people like Catherine, you know, on the Ensemble space. Pick it up, white label it if you want to, otherwise just shoot it as it is and get the client to complete it beforehand because, you know, you'll save them time, you'll save yourself time, you'll reduce your cost to serve and you'll have a much higher engagement with the client. And so that's for the financial planner that doesn't necessarily do a lot of risk, the dabbler, whatever you want to call them, that middle market or financial planner. What does that look like at the moment, Adam, in terms of numbers, right? We've got 15,000 advisors, do we?
Yeah.
About 400 of us write 50% of the risk.
A significant proportion would be either not writing or just, like you say, dabbling.
Yeah.
I'd be doing maybe a couple of policies.
So it's them that we're talking to at the moment.
This is correct.
Yeah. So there you go. So from Catherine and myself and from Adam, we think the number one thing that you could do is pick up that pre-assessment tool and engage with your client that way and ask those health questions.
And if it is online, like if that pre-assessment piece is being done online, it's utilizing the tools available, that next natural step can actually flow through in an underwriting space. So there are providers out there that offer, rather than the old-fashioned phone call with an underwriter for that tele-interview, which we get feedback can often feel like a job interview regardless of the insurer, you can actually now do that online. So a URL link can be sent to the client to complete at their own time without having to talk to some random stranger from an insurer about some of those quite personal questions.
Yep.
So if they like that approach of being able to fill the pre-assessment in, you can actually take a similar approach with respect to the underwriting once that application submitted.
Catherine, when you talk to financial planners, are there any out there that sort of feel a little bit awkward asking some of the questions? You know, because a lot of those health questions are very, very personal. Does that cause any hesitation from financial planners that you're aware of?
No, we haven't had any pullback. They're just glad that somebody else is doing it, because usually it's because they're so uncomfortable themselves. The fact that we're comfortable with it, leads to that comfort. And I will fully admit there are questions that, you know, or conversations I've had with clients where, you know, I'm feeling deeply uncomfortable with some of the turn of the conversation it's taking, but you're sitting there going, yeah, sure, I talk about this stuff all the time. And, you know, and that's the big thing. If you're comfortable, if you're saying, you know, this is every day, you know, it's like a doctor seeing their patient naked, you know. After giving birth to free kids, right? Midwives come in to check in on you, and I'm like, whatever. You know, it's just if you're comfortable, they're comfortable.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're feeling really uncomfortable or embarrassed, you know, then that, you know, clients, there's a risk of them feeling a sense of shame, and that's the last thing you want. So it's not just what you ask, it's how you ask it. And, you know, so you got to do what you can to improve your level of comfort with being uncomfortable and still being caring and compassionate.
Yeah. Okay. So that dabbler that we're talking about, right, that's the larger cohort, what sort of policy numbers are we talking about, Adam?
Look, it varies, but not many.
Yeah. So that 1, 10, 20?
Pretty much. Yeah, 1, 10 or 20, I think, sort of fits into that potential per year.
Yeah.
In terms of that space, they're not really focusing a lot on that area of advice. So we're certainly doing a lot of work through like our Zone Education platform that is providing some intel assistance, even around like that soft skill, that conversation approach. What are some of the things that you can do to help, as Catherine mentioned, talking about some of those personal questions?
Yeah.
And maybe have a better opportunity at a strong conversion rate once they're actually placing that or looking to place that business.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So if you're a financial planner and you're doing sort of 1, 10, 20, number one tip that you can take away from this is to jump on some sort of pre-assessment underwriting tool. Reach out, you know, via the Ensemble platform. You've got guys like Adam and Kath who can provide that detail to you. Make sure that you're reaching out also inside the insurance space. There's lots of questions and answers flowing around. I know David Spiteri's in there putting in some technical detail. And if you've got questions, if you want to be involved in the podcast, if you're curious about how you can go from maybe one policy to maybe 10 or 10 to 20 or start to really build it into the value proposition of your business and the value proposition that you have to the clients, right? We know it's ethically the right thing. We know it's legally the right thing. And we know that commercially, businesses with more risk insurance are more profitable and are growing at a faster rate than the average financial planning practice. So if you're looking to do anything along those lines, jump on the Ensemble space, have a look at some of the resources, and otherwise feel free to get involved. Send me an email at ben.donald@ensemble.com. But otherwise, guys, thanks so much, Kath. Thanks so much for being here, guys. Really appreciate the time.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
Cool. Thank you.